This tape is labeled David Hufford, M.A., April 30th, 1993, Divine Trickster, Holy Fool, Agent Provocateur for the Self. It's labeled tape 2. Well, let's see.
Went in to the elder brother and said, "Your young brother is a wonderful fellow. I have to admit it, he defeated me." The elder brother was a little suspicious. He said, "Well, relate the dialogue to me." He said, "Well, first I held up one finger representing the Buddha, the enlightened one. So he held up two fingers signifying Buddha and his teachings. Well, so I held up three fingers representing the Buddha, his teachings, and his followers living the harmonious life. Then he shook his clenched fist in my face, and a fish too. He shook his clenched fist in my face, indicating that all three had come from one realization and swam in the waters of life." So he won, and so I have no right to remain here. With this, the traveler left. But moments later, "Where is that fellow?" the younger one said, running into his elder brother. "Well, I understand you won the debate." "Won nothing. I'm going to beat him up." Tell me what happened." "Why, the minute he saw me, he held up one finger, insulting me by insinuating that I had only one eye. But since he was a stranger, I thought I would be polite to him, so I held up two fingers, congratulating him that he had two eyes. Then, would you believe it, the impolite wretch held up three fingers, suggesting that between us we only had three eyes. So I got mad and I started to punch him, but he ran away." Let's see. Well, I'll tell one more Zen story and then we'll move on to Sufi. How are we doing here? Tanzen and Ekido were once traveling together down a muddy road. You should know that Tanzen was famous for never paying any attention to the rules. He drank and he hung out in bars and he smoked and he hung out with, you know, everybody. He didn't care. But he was a Zen master anyway, and he was enlightened anyway. So the two of them are walking down a muddy road, and a heavy rain was still falling. Now, you also have to know that Zen monks in this period seem to always be wandering somewhere. They never stayed very long. They were always going from one monastery to another, looking for a good teacher, I suppose. Coming around a bend, they met a lovely girl in a silk kimono and sash, unable to cross the intersection. Things were very muddy. "Come on, girl," said Tanzen at once. Lifting her up in his arms, he carried her across the mud. Ekido did not speak again until that night when they reached the lodging temple. Then he could no longer restrain himself. "You know, we monks do not go near females," he told Tanzen, "especially young and lovely ones. It's dangerous. Why did you do that?" Tanzen says, "I left the girl back there. Are you still carrying her?" Okay, skipping over a few stories here. I want to go right in the time we have left to Nasruddin. Mullah Nasruddin is a Sufi holy fool. He's variously referred to as very stupid, improbably clever, and a possessor of mystical secrets. A holy fool if I ever saw him. Now, his name translates as the defender of the faith. And it is variously said that he lived as early as 993, which is the date on a tomb that bears his name, or as late as the 15th century. But the stories of his are ageless and continue to be told even in modern guise. It is also said that when Nasruddin was a boy, he had the strange ability to memorize. Well, I don't think he memorized very well at all. He had the strange ability to mesmerize his classmates with his stories, and his schoolwork suffered. His teacher was unable to prevent his influence, but being something of a sage himself, he was able to alter it a little, and he put a spell on Nasruddin. He said, "From now on, However wise you become, people will always laugh at you. From now on, whenever one Nasruddin story is told, people will feel compelled to tell at least seven of them. So, I have no choice. I'm compelled to tell seven Nasruddin stories. Luckily, they're fairly short. So. One day, Nasruddin was sitting in the marketplace in front of a basket full of hot peppers, eating one after the other. His eyes were watering, his face was red and contorted, and he was obviously suffering greatly. But still, he continued to eat the hot peppers. When someone finally asked him, "Why are you doing this?" Nasruddin replied, "I'm looking for a sweet one." Well, some local wags got together one day and agreed that they would play a joke on Nasruddin and at the same time have one of his sheep for dinner. So they went to his house and began wailing, "Alas, poor us, tomorrow is judgment day and the end of the world. Oh, what a calamity." Wringing their hands, they said, "Nasruddin, the sheep you have raised with so much patience must not be wasted. We are here to help you eat it." Having said this, they rushed to the sheep and cut its throat. Well, Nasruddin said, "Please, if the end of the world is upon us, I agree. Take off your coats, go sit in the end of the garden where it's nice and cool, and I will cook the meat." Well, all these guys smiled contentedly. They took off their coats, and they went to sit in the garden. Left by himself, Nasruddin built a wood fire, put the pan on, and began to prepare the meal. He put the meat on to cook, and then took all the coats, piled them on the fire, and carefully burned every one of them. When these jokesters came back to eat and saw their coats had been reduced to a pile of ashes, they yelled, "Nasruddin, our coats!" "What?" said Nasruddin. "Tomorrow is the end of the world, and you want to keep your coats too?" Someone saw Nasruddin searching for something on the ground one night. "What have you lost, Mullah?" he asked. "My key," said Nasruddin. So they both went down on their knees and they were looking for it. After a while, not having found it, the other man said, "Exactly where did you drop it?" "Oh, in my house." "Then why are you looking for it out here?" "Well, there's more light out here under the lamp." This one, I swear I've heard in vaudeville. I don't know. I think it's in the Yiddish tradition too. Nasruddin saved up to buy a new shirt. He went to the tailor shop full of excitement. The tailor measured him and said, "Come back in a week, and if Allah wills, your shirt will be ready." The mullah contained himself for 1 week and then went back to the shop. "Ah, there has been a delay, but if Allah wills, your shirt will be ready tomorrow." The following day, Nasruddin returned. "I am so sorry," said the tailor, "but it is not quite finished. Try tomorrow, and if Allah wills, it will be ready." "How long will it take?" asked the exasperated Nasruddin, "if you leave Allah out of it." One day, the villagers thought they would play a joke on Nasruddin. As he was supposed to be a holy man of some indefinable sort, they went to him and asked him to preach a sermon in their mosque. He agreed. Then the day came, and Nasruddin mounted the pulpit and spoke. "Oh, people, do you know what I am about to tell you?" "No, we do not," they cried. "Until you do, I cannot say." "You are too ignorant to make a start on," said the mullah, overcome with indignation that such ignorant people should waste his time. He descended the pulpit and went home. Slightly chagrined, the disputation went to his house again and asked him to preach the following Friday, the day of prayer. Nasruddin started his sermon with the same question as before. But this time the congregation answered as to a man, "Yes, we know." "In that case," said the mullah, "there is no need for me to detain you longer. You may go." And he returned home. Having been prevailed upon to preach for the third Friday in succession, he started his address as before. Do you know or do you not? The congregation, though, this time, they were ready. Some of us do and others don't. Excellent, said Nasruddin. Then let those of you who know communicate their knowledge to those of you who don't. And he went home. Okay, we have, if I'm counting right, we have two more stories. Carrying a load of delicate glassware, Mullah Nasruddin dropped it in the street. Everything was smashed. A crowd gathered. What's the matter with you idiots, howled Mullah. Haven't you ever seen a fool before? Okay, almost one last Nasruddin story. The fair was in full swing, and Nasruddin's senior disciple asked whether he and his fellow students might be allowed to visit it. Certainly, said Nasruddin, for this is an ideal opportunity to continue practical teaching. The mullah headed straight for the shooting gallery, one of the great attractions, for large prizes were offered for even one bullseye. At the appearance of the mullah and his flock, the townsfolk gathered around. When Nasruddin took up the bow and three arrows, tension mounted. Here, surely, it would be demonstrated that Nasruddin sometimes overreached himself. Study me attentively, the mullah flexed the bow, tilted his cap to the back of his head like a soldier, took careful aim, and fired. The arrow went very wide of the mark. There was a roar of derision from the crowd, and the Nasruddin's pupils stirred uneasily, muttering to one another. The mullah turned and faced them all. Silence! This was a demonstration of how the soldier shoots. He is often wide of the mark. That's why he loses wars. At the moment I fired, I was identified with the soldier. I said to myself, I am a soldier firing at the enemy. He picked up the second arrow, slipped it into the bow, and tweaked the string. This time the arrow fell short, halfway to the target. There was dead silence. Now, said Nasruddin to the company, you have seen the shot of a man who was too eager to shoot, yet who, having failed at his first shot, was too nervous to concentrate. The arrow fell short. Even the stallholder was fascinated by these explanations. The mullah turned nonchalantly toward the target, aimed, and let his arrow fly. It hit the very center of the bullseye. There. That's right. Very deliberately, he surveyed the prizes, picked the one which he liked best, and started to walk away. A clamor broke out. Silence, said Nasruddin. Let one of you ask me what you all seem to want to know. For a moment, nobody spoke. Then a yokel shuffled forward. We want to know which of you fired the third shot. That? Oh, that was me. Well, I said that was almost the last story of Nasruddin. The very last one is the last joke that Nasruddin ever told. Because in front of the tomb that is supposed to be Nasruddin's is an immense wooden door, barred and padlocked. Nobody can get into it. Well, at least not through the door. Because oddly enough, there's no fence or wall around the tomb to prevent anyone from simply walking around the gate and into the grave. So, with all of these stories and all of this talk of the trickster, what I want to leave us with is that I'm advocating tonight for a creative attitude, a hermetic approach to life which allows us to open to the playful synchronicity of the self, whether it be in the guise of Coyote, Hermes, or Hotai. We might even be tricked into being more fully who we are, more fully committed to life with passionate detachment. And, you know, I had some other things to tell in example of that, but I'll just tell one of them, that Jung also, I believe, lived his life in the way that I'm advocating and suggesting. And there's a story that Marie-Louise von France tells in the film Matter of Heart about one of the last times that he went to the tower. And she said that he hadn't been there for very long, he hadn't been there for a long time. And the first days, the covers of the pans like to jump off and fall on the floor in the wrong moments. And she says, you know how objects can absolutely misbehave. So he put himself up in the middle of the kitchen and he said, I can't do a young accent. Now, ladies and gentlemen, pots and spoons, I know I have neglected you for a long time, and you are very angry with me, but I beg your pardon. And I ask you now to cooperate again. And from then on, there were no more accidents. And she comments, if you'll notice, it's highly symbolic. The days you can't open the door, you can't get at something, or some object hides itself from you just when you need it, generally just when you're not in yourself, then everything plays you tricks. And Anelia Jaffe says that Jung's approach to losing things or misplacing things was always what I would call hermetic. He always rejected the convenient solution. He preferred, she said, to let things develop in their own way. Don't interfere was one of his guiding maxims, which he observed so long as the waiting and the watching attitude could be adopted without danger. It sprang from a curiosity about life and events. They happen and he let them happen, not turning his back on them, but following their development with keen interest. Jung never ruled out the possibility that life knew better than the correcting mind, and his attention was directed not so much to the things themselves as to that unknowable agent which organizes the events beyond the will and knowledge of man. So when the self approaches us as the trickster, it is calling for one of two creative responses to that sometimes unbearable tension of the opposites. And when I was writing this, the trickster wanted me to say the unbearable lightness of being, but I didn't. Those two creative responses are tears and laughter. Both are part of the trickster's energy and purpose, and both are necessary. As a psychotherapist, I am very aware of how much therapy is a process of acknowledging and attending to grief. Tonight, I have tried to show that laughter is also important and just as healing. Not tears or laughter, but both in their own time. One last story. One night, a stray camel wandered through a field in a village. And in the morning, the children asked an old weaver in the village what the strange footprints were. The old man began to weep. And as he wept, he began to laugh. Why do you weep? And why do you laugh? He was asked. And why do you weep and laugh at the same time? The weaver explained it. I cry because I wonder what these poor children will do for someone to explain things to them when I am dead. And I laugh because as for these footprints, I don't know. I really don't know what they are. Thank you.